from the 1998 Heart of Illinois Convention of Home Educators.
Anyway, it's a delight to be with you this morning. And it's a beautiful day. And we must, of course, thank the Lord for what He gave us, what He is giving us today. This morning I had the distinct pleasure of watching Hillary Clinton on C-SPAN talk about, you know, how we need education reform and smaller classes and national health reform. It was just pure socialism from A to Z, just pure unadulterated socialism. And unfortunately, the audience just ate it up. Of course, she was with a very friendly audience. That's Massachusetts. This was in Lowell, Massachusetts. Anyway, what I'm going to talk about is the new education reform, because you read a lot about it. It's in the newspapers, the magazines, and a lot of people are confused, and many people think that this is something new, but you really cannot understand the nature and scope of the present education reform program coming out of Washington unless you understand that it is the culmination of plans initiated by the progressives about 100 years ago. In other words, what we have today emanating from the U.S. Department of Education and the education establishment in general is the same master plan mapped out by John Dewey and his colleagues at the turn of the century to change America's social order. True, there have been twists and turns, arguments and debates among the educational elite, but all in all, the basic plan of the progressives remains intact. Now, who were the progressives? They were a new breed of educator, members of the Protestant academic elite who no longer believed in the religion of their fathers. They rejected biblical religion as myth and legend and put their faith in science, evolution, and psychology. Science explained the nature of the material world. Evolution explained the origin of living matter. Our original soma emerged from the primordial ooze and through a remarkable series of accidents ended up with us. And psychology provided the means to study human nature scientifically and to control human behavior. Very important, the control of human behavior scientifically established. What more could an educator possibly want? Now, the progressives were also socialists. Why? Because they had to deal with the problem of evil, and they refused to accept the biblical view. The Bible tells us that man is a fallen creature, having disobeyed God by eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and as a result, man is the cause of his own misery. In other words, the origin of evil is man's heart, not the environment or the ozone layer or the stock market. John Calvin characterized fallen man as being innately depraved. Catholics, of course, called it original sin. What Calvin meant is that when man departs from God, he is capable of any depravity he can think of. But the Bible provides a happy solution for all of this, which means that a man can still have a happy, productive, and long life, provided that he live in accordance with God's law. Indeed, his sins can be forgiven, he can be saved, and have eternal life after death if he accepts Jesus Christ as his Savior. In other words, the Bible presents us with the problem of man's sinful nature, but also provides the solution. However, the progressives rejected all of that as myth and legend. But they still had to deal with the problem of evil. What caused it? Since they believed that there was no God, there could be no such thing as sin, which is an offense against God. So where did evil come from? Well, they decided that it came from ignorance, poverty, and social injustice. And what caused social injustice? Why, it was this terrible capitalist system of ours, this dog-eat-dog world of economic competition, private property and individualism which created selfish people. The solution? Socialism, which would replace individualism with collectivism, get rid of private property, or at the very least bring private property under the control of government, and finally get rid of religion with its ridiculous notion of sin that so terribly undermined man's self-esteem. The question then becomes, or became, how do you change America from a capitalist system to a socialist one? The answer was simple. Change the curriculum in the education system so that it would produce little socialists instead of little individualists. The progressives realized that adult Americans were not about to give up their individualism or private property or free enterprises or religion. And so they realized that they would have to educate children in such a manner that they, as adults, would usher in the new socialist utopia through democratic means. And so, beginning in about 1898, the progressives began their messianic crusade to reform American education in order to bring about socialism. The reason why I call the progressive movement a messianic crusade is because of the spiritual aspects of the crusade. You see, the reason why the crusaders had to bring about socialism is because that was the only way they could prove that they were right and the Bible was wrong. They were convinced that once we had socialism, it would be seen that man was not a fallen creature, but was instead imbued with overwhelming benevolence and goodwill. Now, these progressives all came from good Christian homes, and they all knew the Bible. If the Bible was right and they were wrong, they knew where they'd be going. And so they were driven by a strong messianic motive to prove their rightness. Incidentally, the progressives, for the most part, did not get their vision of socialism from Karl Marx, but from an American by the name of Edward Bellamy, who wrote a book entitled Looking Backward, published in 1888. In that book, Bellamy projected the fantasy of a socialist America in the year 2000. If you want to know what that vision was like, read the book. One can say that this crusade began in earnest in 1898 because that was the year in which John Dewey wrote his influential essay, The Primary Education Fetish, in which he singled out high literacy as the great obstacle to socialism because it tended to produce individuals who could stand on their own two feet and think for themselves. Unstated but clearly known by the progressives was the fact that high literacy was also a prerequisite for biblical literacy. What we needed in the primary grades, Dewey argued, was less emphasis on literacy and more emphasis on socialization. In effect, what he was saying was that the masses had to be dumbed down in order to make it easy for the ruling elite to impose socialism, and he outlined a strategy whereby all of this could be done with the public hardly noticing. He wrote, quote, "Change must come gradually. To force it unduly would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction," unquote. Now, that's an interesting statement. If the reforms he proposed were so great, why would they provoke a violent reaction? Obviously, Dewey and his colleagues knew that their reforms would go against the grain of American tradition. Dewey goes on, quote, "What is needed in the first place is that there should be a full and frank statement of conviction with regard to the matter from physiologists and psychologists and from those school administrators who are conscious of the evils of the present regime," unquote. So there you already see in 1898 what the role of the psychologists would be. They were to use scientific arguments to discredit the traditional curriculum. On the crucial matter of primary reading instruction, the first psychologist to answer Dewey's call was Edmund Huey, whose book, The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading, published in 1908, became the Bible of the Look Say Whole Word advocates. They used Huey's book to provide a pseudoscientific justification for getting rid of alphabetic phonics and instituting whole word instruction in its place. Dewey continues, quote, "There are already in existence a considerable number of educational experiment stations which represent the outpost of educational progress. If these schools can be adequately supported for a number of years, they will perform a great vicarious service. After such schools have worked out carefully and definitely the subject matter of a new curriculum, finding the right place for language studies and placing them in their right perspective, the problem of the more general educational reform will be immensely simplified and facilitated," unquote. And so what Dewey was saying to his progressive colleagues was that they needed to try out all of their new ideas in private experimental schools to see what kind of results they would get before implementing them wholesale throughout the public school system. Incidentally, one of the experimental schools that was used for this purpose was the Lincoln School at Teachers College of Columbia University in New York. John D. Rockefeller Jr. gave the school $3 million in 1917 and put four of his five sons in that school. Alvin Moscow, in his book, The Rockefeller Inheritance, writes, quote, "Unlike private schools of its time, Lincoln was coeducational and non-segregated. The Rockefeller boys mixed with children from all walks of life. Boys studied sewing and cooking with the girls, and the girls took shop courses with the boys. Reading, writing, and arithmetic were introduced only when a child was ready and eager to learn. He was expected to pick up these fundamentals out of natural curiosity and desire to learn. Nelson never did learn to spell or master his numbers. Lawrence encountered trouble with his three R's. However, he did make Princeton, where in his freshman year, facing written examinations for the first time, he almost flunked out. Winthrop had the most trouble. He floundered in the freedom and lack of discipline at Lincoln, and in the 10th grade was transformed to the Loomis School, a more formal prep boarding school in Connecticut. Unprepared for the highest scholastic standards at Loomis, at the first marking period, where D was the lowest passing mark, Winthrop earned two E's and three F's, but he liked Loomis and was saved there by his high marks for effort." High marks for effort. I think his father's money also had something to do with it. Unquote. David, the youngest, was the only son who did well at the Lincoln School. He had no trouble with the three R's and eventually went to Harvard. He then went on to become a leader in the international movement leading to world government. Nelson, who was severely dyslexic, hired Henry Kissinger to do his reading and thinking for him. And Winthrop went on to become governor of Arkansas. In any case, by the 1920s, it was already known that known by the progressives that their kind of education had great academic drawbacks, and they had the Rockefeller boys to prove it. But that didn't faze them because that's what they actually wanted. So there is Mr. Rockefeller paying, what was it, $3 million in 1917. You know how much that was worth in 1917? That's probably $30 million today. To have his sons turn into dyslexics, reading failures. He didn't know what was happening. You see, the educators are much cleverer than these rich men. The educators know how to get the money from the rich. And the rich think they're doing a great deed by giving all this money away, like Mr. Annenberg in Philadelphia, who just gave $500 billion? To reform public education. And all that money, you know where it's going? Into the big bottomless pit. It's not going to improve anything. But he thinks he's done a great deed, you see. Now, The reasons why I have gone back to the origins of the progressive education movement is because it is important to know the false premise on which the movement was founded, the premise that evil is caused by ignorance, poverty, and social injustice. 20th century history has proven beyond any doubt the falsehood of that premise. Let me give you proof. One of the most evil men of the century was Dr. Mengele, the Nazi doctor at the Auschwitz death camp, who performed horrible medical experiments on live human beings. Was he ignorant? No, he had the best education Germany could provide. Was he the victim of poverty? No, he was born into a wealthy family with a silver spoon in his mouth. Was he the victim of social injustice? To the contrary, he was a member of Germany's privileged elite. So where did his evil impulses come from? From his innate sinful nature. He put his faith not in God, but in satanic Adolf Hitler, who gave him the freedom to be as evil as his heart desired. So we know that the premise of our education reform movement is false. But there is also a second false premise on which the education reform movement is built, and that is the belief that public educators have the moral right, indeed, the moral duty to change the values and beliefs of the children in their charge without the knowledge or consent of their parents. That was very clearly spelled out in Professor Benjamin Bloom's famous taxonomy of educational objectives published in 1958, in which he wrote, quote, "By educational objectives, we mean explicit formulations of the ways in which students are expected to be changed by the educative process. That is, the ways in which they will change in their thinking, their feelings, and their actions. The evidence points out convincingly to the fact that age is a factor operating against attempts to effect a complete or thoroughgoing reorganization of attitudes and values. The evidence collected thus far suggests that a single hour of classroom activity under certain conditions may bring about a major reorganization in cognitive as well as affective behaviors. We are of the opinion that this will prove to be a most fruitful area of research in connection with the affective domain," unquote. Thus, when American educators speak of subjecting children to a thoroughgoing reorganization of their attitudes and values, what they really mean is getting children to shed their biblical values in favor of humanist values, to shed their belief in absolute moral values in favor of moral relativism and situational ethics. America was founded by people who believed that God was sovereign over our nation and that his law prevailed over the laws of men. Indeed, the U.S. Constitution is a perfect example of man's law being completely compatible with God's law. However, once you reject God, then God's sovereignty and law is replaced by state sovereignty and law. The state then becomes God, and the public educators can claim that they now represent the public good and have the moral duty to train children to serve the secular state, whose compelling interests override all other interests. By the way, it is not at all difficult to trace the history of this reform movement from its very beginning to the present, for the reformers have kept very good records of their progress in the annual yearbooks of the National Society for the Study of Education. The first yearbook was published in 1901. If you study the names of the society's officers, you will find among them the best-known advocates of humanism and socialism, including Harold Rugg, William H. Kilpatrick, Ernest Horn, George S. Counts, John Goodlad, Ralph Tyler, Benjamin Bloom, and many others. You know, people always ask, well, who are they? You know, we keep talking about they, what they are doing, and they think that, you know, that we're making up things. But the they are real people with real names, but they're not names that the public would recognize, because these are people who are in the ivory towers of the universities and are totally insulated from the public. So the public has no idea who are the people pulling these strings? Who are the ones making all of these plans? They have no, they don't know, because their only connection with the public school is the local teachers and the school principal and maybe the school board. They have no idea where all of that comes from. It all comes around the top of the system, the elite, the educational elite who have planned all of this. What is impressive about the Reform movement is its meticulous attention to detail, its continuity, and the way the baton has been passed from one generation to the next, so that there is no change in ideology or ultimate goal. What you find out in studying these yearbooks are the names and associations of the individuals who have been working behind the scenes to effect these reforms over many decades. Because I tell people, I say, nothing that goes on in public education today is an accident. These are not people who are making mistakes or who don't know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing, and the results that you have today are the results they want. The dumbing down is deliberate. Now, I'm just going to give you an idea of one of these people, very prominent, so you can see what he has been doing all these years. One of the most prominent among them is a professor by the name of Ralph W. Tyler, who spent 70 of his 92 years engaged in the ongoing process of education reform. So you probably have never heard of Ralph Tyler. Who is Ralph Tyler? He's one of the key people behind the scenes who's been working at this for 70 years. He died in 1994. An article paying tribute to Tyler in Phi Delta Kappa of June 1994 states, quote, "An activist with a profound belief that demonstration and example are more powerful than ideas that are merely scripted, he harnessed his theorems to social engineering and participated in an astonishing number of watershed events. His monumental 8-year study, his founding role in the National Academy of Education, his creation and 14-year directorship of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, his part in the formulation of the Association for the Evaluation of Educational Achievement, his attainments as university examiner and dean of social sciences at the University of Chicago, and his service as consultant to 5 U.S. presidents. In Tyler's calculus, social fragmentation was a challenge education could meet only through collective accomplishments." Unquote. That last sentence sums up a very important concept held by the progressives, that reform must be organized in a collective manner so that it is carried out uniformly throughout the entire nation in all the schools. And that's why you see all of this happening in, you know, the school to work, Goals 2000, it's in every school district in the nation, all organized nationally, all emanating from Washington, all the money coming from Washington, centrally planned. This is what they've been working on. If reform were left to the localities, it would be fragmented. And fragmentation, although healthy for freedom and local control, would be bad for those who want to reshape the nation according to their own social vision. And that's why they don't want, that's why it has to be nationalized. They want total national control from the top. The article continues, "Intermixed with these achievements, moreover, were his famous rationale on curriculum development, translated into 5 languages, his advisory work with the Spencer Foundation, his labors on the Armed Forces Testing Program, his tenure as president of Systems Development Foundation, and his 15 years as chairman of the National Commission on Resources for Youth," unquote. Well, I can go on and on about Dr. Tyler, because he influenced so many other individuals in the system itself. I mean, he was their mentor. Benjamin Bloom dedicated his taxonomy to Ralph Tyler, you see. So There are all these faceless individuals that you know nothing about who are behind this reform, and they work as a collective, as a group. They have their organization, the National Society for the Study of Education. They have their yearbooks, and they calculate every year meticulously what has to be done next, you see. I'm sure that each one of these men, helped by Tyler, would be able to tell a similar story of dedication to education reform. All of them, I suppose, think that they are doing good. Yet we look at the state of public education today with all of its problems and failings, and I doubt that any of these reformers feel responsible for any of this. They don't even take responsibility for the reading problems caused by the look-same method. In fact, they use the failings of public education as the pretext for generating more reforms, and that's a very important principle. As the system keeps failing, they say, oh, we need more reform. You see, that's how they keep moving incrementally to their ultimate goal, is by saying, oh, well, they produce the failings in order to make it possible to move ahead in their reforms. It's as simple as that. It works like magic, because the public is dissatisfied, and so the educators say, well, we need reform. We're going to give you reform. And, of course, what they give us is not what the public wants, but what the educators want to move them toward their goal. Now, they also talk a lot about democracy and freedom, and yet their reforms are inevitably leading us to a more socially controlled, politically correct society. In other words, they are masters of what Orwell called doublespeak. These men lead a kind of schizoid existence. They live in the ivory tower of the graduate school, financed by government and private grants, totally insulated from parental pressure, writing books, reports, and dissertations for one another, attending professional meetings all over the country and the world, not at all concerned with what they are doing, that what they are doing makes no sense to the average citizen and certainly no sense to the parents who put their children in public schools. And because there is this deafness on the part of this educational establishment, parents are now opting out of the system and putting their children in private schools or homeschooling them. 96 years of committees and yearbooks from the National Society for the Study of Education are totally irrelevant to parents who are truly concerned about the education of their children. Nevertheless, these reformers are now so powerful that with the assistance of the White House, they can get the Congress to pass laws mandating these reforms. For example, in 1994, with the help of President Clinton and the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Congress passed Goals 2000, the School to Work Opportunities Act, and the Improving America's Schools Act. Goals 2000 is raw social engineering intended to restructure all of American society and not just the schools. The School to Work Opportunities Act establishes a formal partnership between the U.S. Departments of Education and Labor, because that's what they're leading us to, a Soviet-style education system where children are trained for specific jobs, They're not given the kind of education that a pure liberal academic education in which you yourself then decide what you want to do with your life. They're now going to plan your life for you. The grant money for this education labor link-up is tied to compliance with the requirements outlined in Goals 2000. It also mandates transforming public education into a glorified voc ed system more in line with a planned economy than a free economy. The Improving America's Schools Act is a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, through which the Johnson administration opened the floodgates of the U.S. Treasury to the educators. Since then, the educators have been able to extract more and more money from the taxpayers by asserting that money will solve our educational problems, while the simple truth is that the more money the educators get, the worse education becomes. Why? Because educational malpractice is very expensive. It's as simple as that. You see, it's easy to teach a child to read with phonics. You know, our ancestors did it with tiny little books that cost practically, you know, a couple of cents. But to teach whole language and look, say, you need, you know, stacks of books with beautiful pictures, You know, one big picture on a page and four words at the bottom. That's very expensive. So that's why they need all this money. If you think that the Republican victories in 1994 have changed anything, I'm terribly sorry to disappoint you. In September 1995, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the Consolidated and Reformed Education, Employment, and Rehabilitation System Act, more simply known as the Careers Act, by a vote of 345-79. In October, the Senate passed its version of the bill, the Workforce Development Act of 1995, by a vote of 95-2. Both bills would federalize public education and bring it under the kind of centralized control that has been the dream of the reformers. So we're almost there, you know, and we have this wonderful Republican Congress that is helping it along. You know, you wonder, why did we elect all these Republicans if they're not going to do anything in favor of freedom and parents' rights? Fortunately, a small group of conservative activists who had read both bills got to their congressman in time and were able to temporarily stop their progress in committee. During the last few months, the bills have undergone revision, but we are not sure what the Republican Congress will finally give us. You know, one thing we do know is that instead of working to get the federal government out of the education business, the Congress will no doubt get it more deeply in. What will be enacted is a human resources development system authored by one of the latest crop of messianic reformers, a man by the name of Mark Tucker, chairman of the National Center for Education and the Economy, an offshoot of the Carnegie Foundation. Tucker is the Ralph Tyler of today, close friend of Bill and Hillary, coordinating the imposition of a Soviet-style education system on America with the help of Congress, a dozen Republican governors, I believe your governor is in favor of it, and some of America's largest corporations. Mr. Tucker describes his vision of American education as, quote, a seamless web of opportunities to develop one's skills that literally extends from cradle to grave and is the same system for everyone, young and old, poor and rich, worker and full-time student, unquote. When he says it's a system for everyone, he means it. For his vision of America is socialist egalitarianism, and that's why homeschoolers must always be on their guard. They don't like the fact that you're escaping from their plans and their system. They mean to get you in there, you know, by hook or by crook. They don't know how exactly they're going to do it. I believe in this state, for example, you have a legislator who is submitting a bill requiring all homeschoolers to inoculate their children in the same way as the public schools. That's their way of getting to you. They have to find a way to make it possible to put the fear of taking your children away. And if that law is passed, and if you don't have your children inoculated, you will be accused of child abuse. And they'll take your kids away from you. See, that's the tactics that they use. Now, she probably got her orders from the Illinois Education Association. You know, these people are racking their brains. How are we going to destroy the homeschool movement? We've got to do something to destroy it. And they're thinking about it, and they think, well, maybe this will do it. Maybe we'll have this requirement, mandated requirement, that all homeschoolers in Illinois must have their kids inoculated. I don't know how many, what are there, 16 different inoculations? Your child will be like a pincushion, you know. No regard for whether a child is allergic to anything. We know that the DPT inoculations have created basket cases of some children. Why do we even need the smallpox vaccination anymore, since they've wiped out smallpox? There are no more smallpox germs in the world, except in two test tubes, one at one of the universities, I think it's in Yale, and also at the Atlantic Center for Disease Control. They refuse to kill the last smallpox bugs that exist because the smallpox bugs are an endangered species. And they have their rights to exist. Well, it's easy to trace the growing power of the education reformers from John Dewey to Mark Tucker. Dewey had no access to the White House, nor did he need one. What he did need was access to the big foundations and their money to finance the early experiments. It's so easy to fool the rich, because the rich have this guilt with all this money. And so the educators come to them and say, oh, why don't you give us all of that extra cash? Create these foundations and it'll support all of this research and reform, and you'll be doing good. You'll go to heaven that way. And that's how the educators and the reformers were able to get their hands on millions and millions of dollars from the very beginning, 1898 onward. In a famous letter Tucker wrote to Hillary Clinton in November 1992, he described in detail his concept of what the newly elected president could do to promote education reform. He wrote, quote, "The object is to create a single comprehensive system for professional and technical education that meets the requirements of everyone, from high school students to skilled, dislocated workers, from the hardcore unemployed to employed adults who want to improve their prospects. Creating such a system means sweeping aside countless programs, building new ones, combining funding authorities, changing deeply embedded institutional structures, and so on. The question is, how do we get from where we are to where we want to be? Trying to ram it down everyone's throat would engender overwhelming opposition," unquote. Now, where did we hear that before? Wasn't it Professor Dewey who said in 1898 that change must come gradually because to force it would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction? Mr. Tucker continues, quote, "Our idea is to draft legislation that would offer an opportunity for those states and selected large cities that are excited about this set of ideas to come forward and join with each other and with the federal government in an alliance to do the necessary design work and actually deliver the needed services on a fast track. The legislation would require the executive branch to establish a competitive grant program for those states and cities and to engage a group of organizations to offer technical assistance to the expanding set of states and cities engaged in designing and implementing the new system. Radical changes in attitudes, values, and beliefs are required to move any combination of these agendas. At the narrowest level, the agenda cannot be moved unless there is agreement among governors, the president, and the Congress," unquote. And so what is required to implement the new education reform is a radical change in attitudes, values, and beliefs, just what Professor Benjamin Bloom and Ralph Tyler recommended back in the 1950s. With Tucker's program, we shall also get a massive intrusion of government into our private lives through the federal computer data gathering system developed by the National Center for Education Statistics. The system will gather detailed personal data on every student and teacher in America. To standardize data collection, the U.S. Department of Education has published handbooks for local use. The first handbook was published in 1964, a second in 1974, and the latest version in 1994, bearing the title Student Data Handbook for Early Childhood, Elementary, and Secondary Education. It runs to about 300 pages. A similar handbook has been prepared for staff. Now, that's a book that you should all have. You should know what kind of information the government is going to be gathering about every child in this country. And the way you get that is from the government. All you do is, I'll give you the code for that publication is NCES 94-303. That's the Student Data Handbook. NCES 94-303. Just call the Department of Education the National Center for Education Statistics and tell them you would like to get this. Now, I was able to get it free of charge because when I would, somebody told me where to get it and how to get it, and I called the department and they sent it to me. I believe now that the government has published it, it's now, you can get it through the government printing office, but it is available and you should read it for yourself to see to what extent the government is going to get involved in your life. What kind of information will they be gathering? Under identification, apart from name and address, they will want to know your driver's license, number, your health record number, Medicaid number, school assigned number, selective service number, Social Security number, College Board ACT number, local education agency number, state education agency number, U.S. Department of Education number. You can have all of these numbers. Under religious background, the government will want to know if you are Amish, Assembly of God, Baptist, Buddhist, Calvinist, Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, Episcopal, Friends, Greek Orthodox, Hindu, Islamic, Jehovah's Witnesses, Jewish, Latter-day Saints, Lutheran, Mennonite, Methodist, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, other Christian denomination, whatever that may be, Seventh-day Adventist, Tao, none, other. Those are the designations in the data collection book. Now, what business is it of the federal government to collect data about your religious affiliation? What about the so-called separation of church and state? What about the right to privacy? What use are they going to make of this information? In the category of assessments, students will apparently be required to take a whole battery of tests that will reveal just about everything there is to know about you. These tests include an achievement test, advanced placement test, aptitude test, attitudinal test. There's going to be an attitudinal test, which the handbook describes as, quote, an assessment to measure the mental and emotional set of patterns of likes and dislikes or opinions held by a student or a group of students. This is often used in relation to considerations such as controversial issues or personal adjustments, unquote. So your government's going to know all about your attitudes, your specific religious affiliation. So if you're a Calvinist, they'll know exactly what your position is. You'll be politically incorrect, you see. Now, what business is it of the government to collect data on your attitudes? Who will have access to this information? And for what reason? There is also a personality test, a psychological test, a portfolio assessment, and a dozen other tests. All of these tests will have been devised by the nation's leading behavioral psychologists whose theoretical goal is the control of human behavior. In fact, what we have in this data-gathering system is an instrument for total social control in the making. And it's there for you to see with your own eyes. Social control from the top through all of these tests that children will be given in the schools. And also, socialized medicine is included because every child will have an individual medical plan. The minute you're born, you'll get your number. And you will get your inoculations, you will be examined and all of that. So we will have socialized medicine through the education system. They had to find a way to get it in. So they'll get it in through the back door. Now, they tried the front door, and they saw the American people didn't want it. The American people do not want socialized medicine because we've seen what happened in Great Britain, the problems they're having in Canada, wherever they've had socialized medicine. You have a decline in medical quality. It has to then be rationed. So they want to take the world's leading advanced nation, which has the best medical system ever developed, and they want to socialize it, and so they're going to do it through the back door, the education system. Now, incidentally, there will also be a small army of health nurses, social workers, psychologists, and counselors to help any student who has a problem. By the way, the counselor is described in the handbook as, quote, a staff member responsible for guiding individuals, families, groups, and communities by assisting them in problem solving, decision making, discovering meaning and articulating goals related to personal, educational, and career development, unquote. Do we really need a paid government employee to discover meaning for us? Have Americans become that helpless? By the way, the only information the public school wanted to know about me back in 1931 when I entered kindergarten was my name, address, date of birth, and my parents' names and address. That was it. And it was all written down by hand on a card. In those days, the idea of limited government still had meaning. But we and the reformers have come a long way since then. The federal government and the state departments of education are imposing school to work all over the United States. The reform movement marches on with Hillary at the lead. And the idea of limited government has gone the way of the gold standard. The government will now plan your life for you from cradle to grave, and most Americans, ignorant of history, will probably accept the new social order. Meanwhile, only the homeschoolers seem to know what to do. As for the future of America, it's a big question mark. Will we finally get the socialism that Dewey and his associates longed for? If the data-gathering system doesn't convince you that our government is up to no good, nothing else will. But it certainly should convince concerned parents that they'd better get their kids out of this human resources development system before it reduces them to helpless dependents who can't make a decision without the friendly assistance of a government official. Now, what do you call such a government? Socialist? Fascist? Communist? Totalitarian? Your lesson for today is to think up a fitting label. Thank you very much.